It's crunch time on 95.3 The Score. And now, the Wednesday special edition of Crunch Time with Steve Tannen and USA Today's George Schroeder. Brought to you by Bi-Mart, just right for the Northwest. It's Crunch Time on 95.3 The Score.
Hello, folks. So there was a period as we welcome you to Crunch Time right here on 95.3 The Score on this final day of July 2019. The trade deadline, a focal point, I'd say the last 48 hours. And the trade deadline has gathered intrigue, obviously, since the playoff field expanded. First,
did we have a trade deadline today, Steve?
There was a kaboomer.
Oh, wow.
So you got to understand, once upon a time, 50 years ago, two teams got in. Then four teams got in. Then actually, it was supposed to happen prior to the 1994 season, but they went on strike and canceled it. And then, of course, they added the extra wild card. And all that means is teams who a little above 500 are like, we're in this thing. We could
yeah,
win it.
Baby.
And you've got to understand, while it hasn't always been commonplace, I'm pretty sure one of the giant World Series teams, they only won 88 games. So it's not like they were blowing teams out of the water. They were 88-74, won a wild card game, and then won the World Series. So teams were thinking, well, we're four or five games over 500. If we add an ace and bolster our bullpen, it'll take us from what we are, a team who wins 53% of the games. All of a sudden, if we get to 60 and we get hot and we've got a legitimate 1-2 punch and we already had a good offense, we're in it. And then we got to about, I would say, 11-hour time today. So 2 hours before the deadline. And all you were hearing is dud and rumors. And all of a sudden it was like, da-da-dun, da-da-dun, dun-dun-dun. Would I be accurate in saying the biggest move today was Zach Greinke relocating to Houston? You got a Cy Young winner having a big season, big dollars, teaming up with Verlander. I mean,
and Garrett Cole.
Well, I know Cole is great, but he's not ticketed for the Hall of Fame.
But he might win the Cy Young this year.
Like, no, he's great. He's great. I just, my level of postseason trust, he's 75% of the way there to where I think he's an elite pitcher rather than having a great season. I'm acknowledging the season.
I understand, but as much as you value what's gone on in the past, like, Greinke hasn't been all that great in the postseason either.
No.
But you think about what the three of them are doing right now, and where you get into a postseason series, if you're like, hey, we've got two really good starters, like, they'll get us four starts in the best of seven series, and maybe we'll have to pitch both of them out of the bullpen in game seven if it gets there. Now you've got three of those guys that are just going to eat up innings with a bullpen that is incredibly strong that can come through on the other, you know, two games in a series that you need them. That's absolutely incredible. Like, there's knowing you're good enough and going for it, and then there's what the Astros are doing and going for it and doing it.
One of the things that I always love about the big sports we follow, it's like you take a never team like Houston, and all of a sudden now they're in a good spot to win two out of three. And then Verlander's not showing signs of letting up. Greinke is signed for big bucks for next year and the year after. They just got Cole from Pittsburgh. When I say just, I mean, in essence, he's a new Astro. And Correa and obviously Altuve and Bregman. I mean, they look like New York looked in the late 90s. It's like, well, they're probably not going anywhere soon. But the trick is, it's like, I feel like these organizations who build a powerhouse, it's like the goal is to get those four World Series like the Red Sox or Yankees and not become the Braves, not be, well, they won the one and they spent the next 8 years trying to get a second one.
But and they still got Bregman, Jose Altuve, George Springer, rounding out the outfield, Correa. Like, this team is they're
built to
very,
last.
Very, very
it,
good.
It looks like they're built to last. The Braves.
There's something with that pitching staff, because what they turned Verlander, what he was becoming in Detroit, to what he's like refreshed himself, maybe by not living in Detroit or something, but he's refreshed himself and he's even back to like Cy Young MVP, well, not MVP form, but like he's back into a Cy Young contender as well. And you're doing this with Greinke, who's like kind of slowed down a little bit, but has still been as consistent as ever, was leading the National League in whip. Now all of a sudden he's second in the American League because Verlander's been that good. Cole's like fifth in the American League. The Astros just got so much better. It's unbelievable.
Question.
Sure.
A lot of people have been trained, even though it has not been the case in recent years, that the Yankees are always a big player. But they've altered their philosophy. Not changed, not completely flushed that they have the capability and the resources that few others do. I'm thinking they probably talked and were like, we're not giving up 3A prospects. That's not how they were able to sustain. You know, there was the passing of Boss George. Then there was the little power struggle where it was like kind of between Cashman, one of the Steinbrenners, Girardi, how are we going to do this? Cashman won out, and he is not about mortgaging. And with their starting pitching, would they have become the team to beat if they got Greinke? I think that you're going to see a couple of call-ups, and they're going to hope to get, like, back in 78 when they brought a guy named Jim Beattie up for 78, and he won a big playoff game, and he pitched well in the World Series, rather than mortgage what they've done, because their farm system, as you've seen in recent years, is a powerhouse.
That's very good, and they've rebuilt, and that's what they've become, with the exception of, like, what, Stanton?
Right, right. Like, if you delete Stanton, you wouldn't even think they were built like they were the Yankees.
Right. It's just, this is another Astros team that they just didn't get as bad as the Astros did as they rebuilt the farm system. They're very good. But it's almost like Cashman was playing this, like, there's another trade deadline coming, and he's like, okay, we can wait out the Giants, and they'll realize, they'll fall five games back just like that. They'll be out of it. Then we can get Bumgarner for him, and yeah, he's got to clear waivers, blah, 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 whatever. Like, we can do that. Then that'll work. But it's, everybody knew that the Yankees needed a starting pitcher to add that extra level to their team, because it's their one gaping hole.
Like,
that
is a big one.
It's gigantic. Like, if you don't have starting pitching, the bullpen sure is good, but they didn't add anything to the bullpen really either. Like, it was just, everything just came down to they need starting pitching, and everybody knew that they needed it, and they were just trying to rake them over the coals and get like extra prospects thrown in because they can, and they good for them.
And the Braves realized we need bullpen help. And they picked up Mark Melancon from the Giants, who, truth be told, was a complete bust as a closer when they obtained him prior to the 2017 season. He hasn't been awful this year. I mean, a reliever with a 3.5 ERA isn't a super-duper star. But they also boosted the bullpen by getting Shane Green from the Detroit Tigers, who has been an absolute monster out of the Motown pen. So, yeah, we've got a lot of that to cover, much to talk about as NFL camps are opening. We were talking about the Pac-12 yesterday and, how certain defenses Oregon will face this year are looking. But right now, it's that time on a Wednesday. We'll get our view from the middle. Word has come down. He has not been traded from USA Today on this trade deadline Wednesday. He stays with them and will continue to cover college football. The red section of the paper online, usatoday.com, on Twitter, it's at George Schroeder. George, how are you on this final day of July?
Man, I'm good. And it's hard to imagine that we are almost to the month when college football begins. And I don't mean everybody going starting camp, because Arizona's already done that, right?
Right.
I mean, we're going to have actual games next month, meaning tomorrow, and tomorrow we can say this month.
Right. I love it. And as a matter of fact, the games, a lot of big games, with I think Miami's playing. It's 3 weeks from Saturday. It's unbelievable. It's awesome. So, yeah. Last week, you covered Pac-12 Media Day. There was a few things we were unable to cover. It's almost like if the Pac-12 were Sesame Street, the magic number is two. You got the Arizona schools, Oregon, Oregon State, UCLA, coach entering year two. Chip Kelly, it looks like he probably has his quarterback. The three games they won were over the final 7 weeks. They were picked tied for third in the South. From what you've observed or who you've been speaking with or what you witnessed last week, what's reasonable to expect improvement-wise from UCLA this year?
Well, I think that would be a lot better just because they'll understand the culture better. And they played a ton of young guys last year who sort of got baptized by fire, and we'll see how they are. I think the thing that is a little concerning long-term is what the recruiting rankings say about UCLA. Now look, Chip Kelly would tell you he's looking for his kind of guys, and he looks for a little bit different than other guys do. But there's a reason that those recruiting rankings are out there too. And if you're at UCLA, you're not USC, but you ought to be able to pick up some pretty nice guys. So I think long term, there's some reason for kind of just a little bit of question about how it's going to go. I have a lot of faith in Chip Kelly at getting it done, but I think they'll be better this year. And I think you're looking at a program that could potentially be a bowl team, which I think would be a big jump for them, obviously, from what they won a year ago. It doesn't get a lot easier, though. I mean, everybody can point to week two when Oklahoma comes to Pasadena.
Right.
You can point to that all you want. And I think Oklahoma may take a step back from what they were the last couple of years, and we'll see, right? That's one of the fascinating storylines in college football. But I still think even on the road, they're going to handle UCLA. So it's not like so there's one of your three non-conference games right there that's troubling.
Talking with George Schroeder, Herm Edwards, we've talked about this. A lot of people were surprised when he got hired, hadn't been in the college game for about 30 years. And year one, they beat Michigan State. They beat Utah, won at USC, won the Territorial Cup. They finished the regular season pretty well. They've got a terrific back in Eno Benjamin. But, man, they lost some talent. Their quarterback, their receiver, N'Keal Harry. What was the buzz about the Sun Devils at Pac-12 Media Day?
Well, I think people don't really know. I mean, look, here's the deal. I don't think you understand how good Manny Wilkins was, a quarterback, just as a veteran. And N'Keal Harry, obviously, is a big-time star at wide receiver. But when they had Manny Wilkins, one of the things that they did last year that I think got overlooked a little bit is they changed their offensive style in a very NFL way to sort of fit what they thought would work against defenses, which is not what you typically see from offenses. Now, I'm not saying that we're radically different. It's not like they went from the spread to the wishbone to the power eye. I mean, I don't mean that. I do mean that they morphed their offense to fit what they thought would work against defenses more than other programs typically do. And I'm not saying that's a great long-term strategy. I'm just saying it is what they did. And so for that reason, I think it's important to note that they're going to end up with a true freshman at quarterback?
It looks like it.
Now, maybe the junior, Dylan Cole Sterling, will be the guy, but it feels like they're going to end up with a true freshman quarterback pretty soon. And that, to me, limits what you can do, at least in changing things around offensively all year long. So I think you tell me who's going to be the quarterback, how good they're going to be, and then I'll have a much better idea of what I think about ASU this year.
Let's get to the other Arizona school, Kevin Sumlin, who had big success, Case Keenum at Houston. Obviously, Manziel won the Heisman at A&M. There were injuries to Khalil Tate last year, though they had a better season defensively than I think offensively. They've got a terrific running back in J.J. Taylor. They actually have some talent returning. What were folks saying about the Wildcats' outlook for this year?
Well, first of all, they started camp last week. They started camp a week ago Thursday, so the day after media day, which is crazy, but it's because they're playing that week zero game out at Hawaii, right? So, there's a lot of good things going on with Arizona. They've got a new indoor facility, which it's amazing that you wouldn't have had that at Arizona. given the fact that it's not that it's rain that's a problem for them. It's that it's hot. I don't know if you figured that out, but it's really hot in Tucson in August and September and maybe even in October. So there's a lot of good stuff going on. But, man, they lost a bunch of games by a bunch of points. Can they, A, keep Khalil Tate healthy, and, B, can they? Is he going to be happy, content? Because I think that was part of the untold story last year, was that Khalil Tate, I think they tried to do some things to fit him, to let him fit into sort of a passing style. And is he going to be willing to sort of be a dual threat guy, which is what he is? I don't know the answer to that, but he's going to need to be more disciplined, and they're going to need to just basically tell him, "Hey, look, your best bet is to be able to let us run you some." We'll see.
Talk with George Schroeder, USA Today. From a strict rankings standpoint, Cal was a unique team. They were 15th in total defense, 115th in total offense. They've got Evan Weaver, who's a terrific defender. I guess they'll go Chase Garbers at quarterback. Limited positive support in the media poll. Is there any sense after improving year two from year one that they keep the graph moving upward and Justin Wilcox has his Golden Bears on the rise?
Well, listen, their defense is going to be really, really good again. It might be better than it was a year ago when it was good. But the question with them has always been, can they be better at quarterback? Can they actually score touchdowns? I mean, you know, listen, if you want to think about what Cal was, think about the fact that they upset Washington last year, and they did it without scoring a touchdown offensively. They won 12-10, didn't need an offensive touchdown to do it. That's how good they were defensively, but it's how inept they were offensively. You know, Washington obviously had a defense too. So the question with Cal is, are they going to be better offensively? I talked to Justin Wilcox last week in L.A., and he's pretty optimistic. But look, Steve, name a coach who's not optimistic this time of year, right?
They
especially
better be.
Publicly, especially for public consumption, right? So do I think that they've got a shot to be much, much better offensively? Yes, I do. But we still don't know really if it's, you know, how that's going to work out. And I guess I'm wait and see on Cal, too. I will say this. Utah's really good in the South.
Yep.
After that, it feels like there's a lot of room for maneuvering down there. But there's not a lot of room in the North, which makes it tough.
Couple final thoughts. There's a website called coacheshotseat.com, and you know, they list guys up there, Lovie Smith of Illinois, even Willie Taggart, but number one, they have Clay Helton of USC. And since the Pete Carroll era of domination ended, they've been to one major bowl. They won the Rose Bowl. It's been 10 seasons. They're 5-7 last year. This is his fourth full year running the show. How accurate is it to say he faces the most pressure of any coach in this league?
In the Pac-12, it's not even close. I mean, I thought you were going to say in country, and I was going to say, well, we could just sort of, it sort of depends.
Right.
In the Pac-12, I don't think it's even close. He's clearly the guy with the most pressure. And I think it's legit to have him number one overall as on the biggest hot seat of any coach in college football. Is it fair? No. Is it real? Yes. And so, you know, if they're not significantly better, not just than they were a year ago, but, you know, obviously 5-7 is unacceptable at USC. But let's be honest, 8-4 is unacceptable at USC. 10-2 is barely acceptable at USC. You know, they're expected to win Pac-12 titles and contend for playoff berths and win national championships. And if they're not going to do that, then the coach is going to be in trouble. Look, they got a really short memory about what he did the first 2 years on the job,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
They got a really short memory. But when you go 5-7 at USC, you've got zero margin for error. And it's one thing to go win a Rose Bowl and a thrilling win over Penn State. That's terrific. It's one thing to win a Pac-12 title. That's great. But we all saw how far behind Alabama they were. Was that his first game? Yes, I get it. But the point is, they're supposed to be competing with and beating the Alabamas of the world. At least that's what USC fans think. And I think Clay Helton's a terrific coach. I don't know if he's the right coach for them. But if they don't win 9 or 10 or 11 games this year, he's gone.
Yeah, I don't even think there's a doubt. And lastly, one of the issues that surfaced last week was the amount of conference games. You retweeted the legendary Bay Area writer, John Wilner, who said there's no discussion to go from 9 Pac-12 games to 8. If you had to predict, would you say the Pac-12, Big Ten, and Big 12 would drop to 8? The SEC and ACC will jump to 9? Or for the immediate future, probably nothing either way?
Nothing's happening either way for the immediate future. Eventually, you are going to see the other leagues go to 9. That is going to happen. You are not going to see leagues drop to 8. First of all, the Pac-12, you can't do everything for the playoffs. Okay.
Right.
but the Pac-12 goes to 8, and suddenly that it creates a problem of finding another non-conference game. That's not an easy thing to do for anybody this time of year. In college football now, it's really not an easy thing to do for the West Coast teams, because there are fewer sort of Middle Tennessee State level programs sitting out there that are easy to get to come to your place for some reasonable price. And by the way, you suddenly got to pay some premium price if you had to get a home game. If you had a non-conference game, if you drop from 9 conference games to 8, then obviously you're gonna add a non-conference game, and suddenly you're gonna be spending $1 million, $1.5 million to bring somebody in. So they're not dropping to 8. I'll say that.
Yeah.
Nobody's moved. The ACC and the SEC are not moving to 9 soon, but they are moving to 9.
Yeah.
Because they're gonna have to, for a lot of reasons.
No, I think having that uniform would actually aid everybody in the long run. Folks, he's George Schroeder, USAtoday.com online, the red section of the paper. On Twitter, it is at George Schroeder. George, as you mentioned, when we speak next week, we'll be talking about the season starting this month. Always appreciate it. Look forward to it. Great information as always. Chat next Wednesday.
Cannot wait.
Have a good one, George. All right, 284-8571, the Oregon Fuel Injection Hotline. We've got MLB Network, and it's like I'm still in pre-1 o'clock mode. So I'm watching, then I just caught myself. I was like, it's done, Steve, relax. It's all going to fall into place.
We're riding the waves of technology just for you. You can call the Oregon Fuel Injection Hotline at 284-8571. Text 321-0824. Tweet Steve at SportsTalk953.
Up and in is very different than in. And I'm sure, I know Aaron Boone, Alex Cora, whoever you would talk to in baseball that has played forever will acknowledge, sure, you got to throw in, but you never have to throw up, especially when you're trying to make a point.
God, these people. That was Carl Ravitch. You know, it's funny, as we welcome you back to Crunch Time on 95.3 The Score, on a different day in Major League Baseball, like not today, the story would have been that crazy brawl between the Reds and Pirates, and it was still a big story until about 11:45 our time, when, you know, Greinke moved to the Astros and the Braves acquired Melanson and who's the other bullpen guy they got? Green. Chad Green from the Tigers. And Sam Dyson to the Twins is not getting a lot of play. That's big. He's a good bullpen guy from your Giants.
I want to go back to the brawl. That was fantastic. That was an actual fight that happened. That was not a baseball shove around, throw out, like
what a nut, by the way.
Oh my God, that's insanity. You're talking to your coach at the mound. The home plate umpire next to you, and you still decide,
nope,
I'm fighting for my boys right here, right now. Woo! Taking on an entire bench alone. No backup at all. No backup.
Nope.
Charging through to the bullpen and landing a wicked haymaker as well. That was spectacular. Like, I know baseball doesn't want fighting and people throwing at each other's heads, and everything that led up to that point was really not good for baseball, and it's kind of toxic, and like, please, guys, let's grow up and not throw baseballs at each other's heads. But, oh, man, if you're going to stick up for your team by charging at an entire bench alone, and the manager, the Reds manager got...
ends up at the bottom of the pile.
He was ejected earlier in the game, runs out of the dugout, and ends up at the bottom of the pile, pushed Clint Hurdle over. I didn't even know he was still managing. All of this was incredible. Just phenomenal stuff.
The funny thing is, and by the way, the best part about it is they got to play today, which kind of eased the tensions. And Ravitch and a couple of the guys on ESPN and MLB Network are right, though. The jerk store called. They're out of the Pirates. Their pitchers are headhunters.
Oh,
these
they're
idiots.
They're very bad. And all of this started like 2 months ago as well, when like Puig ended up, like, I don't know how it happened, if it was just the right camera angle for a split second of time, but whatever happened in Pittsburgh, like back in April.
Was it May?
April.
I'm not sure,
yeah,
right.
May sounds more right. But like, there was a picture of Puig, like just one perfect moment of time of Puig in his red and the Pirates in all of their yellow or their black or whatever jerseys they were wearing. And he was alone. And Puig was completely prepared to fight the entirety of the Pittsburgh Pirates. And now they've got some random relief pitcher who wants to do the same thing.
The best part about it is at the time, Puig probably didn't even realize he wasn't even on the Reds anymore.
Oh, yeah. He had been traded for like an inning and a half. He had an at bat after he had been traded as well. None of that made sense, and that just added to the hilarity of it too. He fought Kyle Crick, who is actually a former Giant, and one of the Giant beat writers I follow on Twitter made a joke like, oh, when so-and-so tells you that Madison Bumgarner's a really nice guy, and then it was a gif of Puig going after Kyle Crick, which was hilarious, and just guys are getting thrown in chokeholds and pushed around, and just like, baseball fights aren't supposed to happen like 3 feet in front of the stands in the front row. They're supposed to be, you know, out by the pitcher's mound when the batters charge out there. Oh man, that was phenomenal.
I have never seen in baseball any kind of reaction like Amir Garrett, because normally what do you see? How does a baseball fight start? Either a guy does a hard slide. Is that a double play?
Oh,
no, that's
God.
Impossible. Not, by the way, ooing and eyeing to a video on radio.
I know. It was Iglesias for the Reds in this Pirates game. He picked up a ground ball. He's the shortstop going to his left. Did a 360 on top of second base, touched the bag, threw the first, and turned a double play. That was a work of art.
Put that on a t-shirt.
But what Amir Garrett did, normally if a guy throws at a guy, you'll see, in essence, one guy will charge the mound, or a pitcher will just wave him on, like, let's go. It was just like, yeah, talking to my manager, and like, all of a sudden, somebody set off an alarm, and he just took off. I'll tell you what, if the only thing I've ever seen in sports like this was a video that was unearthed earlier. If you go to Google and go Willis and Google and Willis Reed takes on the Lakers, the Knicks center, and this is like in 1967 or 1968, he must have made contact and punched like five members of the Lakers. He lost his gosh darned mind. This was the other time I've seen that. And you know what my favorite thing is? Who's the pitcher that started it? Jared Hughes called it, the report was an errant pitch. And he says it threw a load of fuel onto one of the major's most flammable rivalries. And it's like, all right, that's pretty clever. So on Tuesday, he hit Marte with his first pitch.
That's sending a message, correct?
And I love his explanation. The ball slipped. It was unfortunate. A lot of bad things happened after. Okay.
Isn't that a bit of an understatement?
Yep. They and by the way, you mentioned Cincy's manager, David Bell.
Yeah.
So he had been tossed. You can't come back out of the locker room.
That is very much against the rules.
He's going to sit again. And he went after Clint Hurdle.
Yes, that's right.
Wow. Amazing. And by the way, now Puig is on the Indians, and now Bauer is on Cincinnati. I mean, that trade has almost been forgotten. in the aftermath of that insanity and all that's gone down on today, trade deadline Wednesday.
I mean, it's wild enough that the Reds like didn't learn about the trade or like get enough confirmation to be able to like pull Puig out of the situation before it happened. But like everybody like knew about the trade, and then they, you know, everybody turns on their MLB TV. Okay, like Puig's gonna say goodbye. We're on hug watch. We gotta watch him say goodbye to his teammates. He's been a load of fun for that Reds team as they've been wearing all those weird throwbacks, like without the sleeves on them and stuff like that. Like they've been having a grand old time over there, and it was just like, okay, it'll be a fun thing. Let's watch Puig say goodbye. And then all of a sudden the brawl happens. Like the entire baseball world was watching when this happened, and there was just, you know, a novella's worth of information that had happened in like the inning and a half before the entire baseball world was watching this game with an incredible brawl as well. Oh, just Leroy Jenkins the hell out of that.
I just, forever, I will have that dude in my mind. It's like, I will never trust another mound meeting again, because I'll assume that the pitcher being talked to is secretly thinking, I want to kill them all. I want to just break out of this conversation and run with all my speed and just start punching people.
I mean, I don't know what was going on with the Pirates either, because like their team is up to bat, but like for obviously
they had to be yelling something.
Like somebody's chirping and stuff, but like all of those guys have to be in the dugout at like pretty much at all times, unless you're like the on deck batter or whatever. Like, you know, keep guys in the dugouts unless you're supposed to be on the field, but. What is going on to the point where you're so into this game and chirping at
an early?
Yeah, and chirping at this pitcher to get him to come over to you like he can't hear you. And when he starts charging, your first reaction is to hop over the gate or whatever, hop over the mound of the railing in the dugout.
Right.
And you're like, okay, like he's charging at me. I'm going to make sure that I go out to the field to meet him as opposed to him running into the dugout, which would have been such a worse optic of one man charging into a dugout to start a fight.
That just adds days to your suspension. And another thing, Garrett is a big dude.
Yes.
He's 6'5", 230, and he had a head of steam up, like a running back that really needed that first down on third and short.
He knew exactly who he was going after. He tossed his glove. He lined up whoever he was going to hit, and he unloaded on him, too. And I don't know if he's right or left-handed, but as soon as he was charging over, I thought of Bull Durham, and I was like, you always hit with your non-throwing hand. Like, you got to be smart enough to do that, and I don't even know if he did it. Because I can't remember now if he's right or left-handed.
I don't think he can. No, that was the problem. He's lefty.
Oh, he punched with the throwing hand.
Yeah,
that'll
no, he totally broke the Crash Davis rule and went meet Lelouch.
That could be why the punch landed so well. Is he's a southpaw, and he actually went with the strong left hand there. I think that's something similar to what like Bryce Harper did when he charged the Swiss cheese of people, Hunter Strickland, who thank the Lord is out of the Pacific Northwest today, which is just, you know, another random thing that happened. But when Harper went after Strickland, Harper unloaded, like he got a really, well, threw the helmet that whiffed way wide, which was also hilarious. But when he threw the punch at Strickland, he like barely missed his aim a little bit, and he like crunched the bill. It turned into like an accordion for a second, as it was just all completely compressed in, and then he got blindside tackled by Jeff Samardzija, and Jeff Samardzija like slammed into Mike Morse and gave Mike Morse a concussion, and it knocked him out for the rest of the season. Oh, that one fight had so many layers to it that was so weird, on top of just like Hunter Strickland being just a child. Man, baseball brawls are fun. Like Major League Baseball shouldn't want them, but they are fun.
I am so happy I remembered that, because if you haven't seen it, you got to check it out. I it's very rare. I mean, we talk about in baseball things we've never seen. Like already the Twins have set the record for most 5 home run games. It's like those are on-field accomplishments. If you want just complete and total, out of control, lost it, I'm criminally insane, I should be committed madness, just go to either MLB.com or ESPN.com and just click on the Reds or Pirates and just click on last night's score. Trust me. It'll come up, and you will not believe what you saw this dude, Amir Garrett, do. All right.
Oh, now I'm rewatching the Harper-Strickland fight, and oh man, it's a good one. Harper got a really good, like, the bat flip went way wide, and, like, that was crazy. He pointed at him with the bat, like, oh, let's go. Buster Posey, who was, you know, a father of many children, obviously didn't want to deal with another child on the mound in Hunter Strickland. But, man, like, Strickland throws a punch, Harper tries the counter, and then he comes back with the right, and I'm pretty sure Harper throws right-handed, right? But he definitely bats lefty. But that's the one that he landed with his right hand into the brim of Hunter Strickland's hat that, if it had connected with his nose, would have broken it. Like, he would have just destroyed him.
Let's do an over-under here. We know when he was with the Dodgers, Puig was at the center of brawls. His last day with the Reds, right in the middle of a brawl.
Right.
So it's July 31st. Does he make it through August without being in the middle of a brawl with Cleveland? Remember, they're actually in it. He's got a different manager who's had a lot of success. You saw how pissed Francona got when Bauer threw the ball over the wall. So will we, over under this year, will we see Yasiel Puig in the middle of another brawl in 2019?
So the over under is half of a brawl?
Yeah.
See, when he was with the Dodgers and he would get into kerfuffles with the Giants, it was just, he was a red ass running into Madison Bumgarner, who was a red ass, and they just tried to out-red ass each other. And it's like when you take two magnets that are both, like, you know, north or whatever, and you try and push them towards each other and they just don't get along. Like, that's kind of what it was. There was I think one or two did end up happening, of course, because, you know, guys just rush out of the dugouts just because. But yeah, I don't know who really disliked the Indians. I'm guessing something is going to happen with the Twins. They'll run into some late season series, and, you know, someone will get thrown at or kind of thrown at, and Puig will just yell at somebody about something, and that'll spark it. So yeah, I'm going to take the over here. He's gonna start a kerfuffle.
It's gonna happen. All right, let's lock up the Oregon Fuel Injection Hotline. A quick word about the Josh Cooley team, who have announced their. Talking about this new housing subdivision in Eugene, it's located at Ayers Road and Delta Highway. 68 home development. It's called the Enclave at the Nines. They're taking reservations. The homes are pretty cool. Talking some real upscale stuff, 1,800 to 2,100 square feet. 3-bedroom, 4-bedroom models are available. You could check out the website and see all the designs, 3-bedroom, 4-bedroom, various options on the master bedroom, whether you want it on the main level. The website is EugeneEnclave.com. There are 6 floor plans available, and the best way is to learn about it. Make the phone call, 359-1999. You could also text. It's a multi-year project. And, of course, if you've got to sell your home first, call the best in the business and make this a smooth transition. Again, 359-1999. The project is the Enclave at the Nines. And it's courtesy of our friends at the Josh Cooley Real Estate Team.
All rise, all respect the bell. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the last segment on a Wednesday for Crunch Time, which means it is the Crunch Exchange. I bring up a prospectus from the world of sports, I being Nick. Hi. And Steve over there tells us if he is buying or selling. We begin. Michael Thomas is a very talented wide receiver, but it's quite unfortunate that he plays for the worst franchise in the NFL in the New Orleans Saints. But hey, you know, plenty of good players want to play for bad teams, and it works out just fine for them. Thomas got an extension this morning that is 5 years, $100 million, 61 of those guaranteed. This is after 3 years in the NFL where he had 321 receptions, 3,787 yards, 23 touchdowns in 47 games. He's been compared a lot to Julio Jones because Julio is one of the most dominant receivers in the NFL for his first 3 years as well, but didn't get a contract extension until his fourth year. Julio's extension was 5 years, $71.3 million. Julio getting to the end of that contract now with 2 years remaining, and the Don, Arthur Blank, has promised that Julio will be taken care of in a very good way and will be properly compensated. Thomas's $100 million is 10 more than the Giants gave Odell, and when the two of them were both 26 when they got these extensions, so the market has just been reset for young wide receivers, but it hasn't it also for older, more proven ones like Julio Jones. The prospectus, Julio Jones will get more money than Michael Thomas.
Oof. Thomas is 25. Julio's older than that.
30.
Yeah. It's not a matter of who's had or who will go down as a better NFL receiver. I think it's about logic and the fact that New Orleans knows that considering Drew Brees played in the 2001 Rose Bowl, his window is shrinking. So I'm going to sell that.
Fair enough. Plenty of big moves happening today at the deadline, but the biggest one happened last night. Well, I guess I wrote this before the Zach Greinke trade. So one of the bigger ones happening last night was Trevor Bauer was sent from the Cleveland Indians to Cincinnati Reds for Yasiel Puig, and the Padres were also involved in all of this somehow. The Indians didn't do much in the offseason, and it hurt them as they fell pretty far behind the race for the AL Central. They've worked themselves back now to 3 games in the division and have a 2-game lead to host the wildcard game. Cleveland has been dealing with plenty of injuries this year, but the exception of Bauer, who was leading the team in innings pitched. Now Corey Kluber is set to return from his forearm injury sometime in August. Danny Salazar will be activated tomorrow, and Zach Plesac, in the meantime, has had a pretty serviceable 3.1 ERA. The Indians get their bat, and they don't have to deal with Bauer anymore, so that's a win-win for them. And Cleveland is chasing Minnesota, who didn't add much at the deadline other than 2012 World Series-ending closer Sergio Romo. And people forget he struck out Triple Crown-winning Miguel Cabrera looking with a fastball. That was Romo's third-best pitch. They also added Sam Dyson again after I wrote this. The race has become quietly close. The prospectus, the Windians, fueled by some fresh Puig, win the AL Central.
I'm not in love with that move. Pitching. I'm going to sell that.
Ooh. Alrighty then. The race for the NL East is also very interesting as the Phillies have started to load up. Going back to the Jay Bruce trade, the Phillies have added Brad Miller, Corey Dickerson, Drew Smyly, Jason Vargas, Blake Parker, Jose Perella, and Mike Morin. Most of those names are pretty unknown even to me, but it's showing that the Phillies are desperate to not look like fools after throwing a ton of cash at Bryce Harper and then missing the playoffs the same year. They're going all in on October baseball, even if it just means that play-in game. The Nationals went all in on fixing their bullpen, adding relievers, Daniel Hudson from the Blue Jays, Rowan Salinas, and Hunter Strickland from the Mariners. Also not wanting to be caught are the Braves, who added Tigers reliever Shane Green, as well as Mark Melancon to bolster the back end of their bullpens. So the race is shaping up with Atlanta up 5.5 on Washington, up 6 on Philly, with the Phils tied with the Cubs, and what would lead to a play-in game to be the visitor in the play-in game. The prospectus, because of all of their moves, the Phillies will make the playoffs. Play-in game counts. Play-in game to a play-in game, I'm going to say, doesn't count.
I don't think they did enough standing pat. I don't think they'll catch Atlanta, who I like what they did to bolster their bullpen. Washington, I just think, has a better rotation. And I think year one, Bryce Harper ends up with them as postseason spectators. Ooh. Sell it.
So close. The trade deadline was DOA at 1 p.m. specific time. There were 14 trades, according to Carl Ravitch of ESPN, who I trust can count better than I can. And then all hell broke loose. The Giants became sellers, getting rid of Sam Dyson. They were also buyers when they added Scooter Gennett for some reason. I mean, sure. But the biggest shock by far was the Astros landing Zach Greinke from the Diamondbacks. I typed that wrong. The Astros starting rotation is now Verlander with a .81 whip, Garrett Cole an even one, and Greinke with the former NL leading .94 whip as well. It was already going to be tough to beat the Astros in a best of 5 or 7, knowing that basically 4 starts were going to be Cole and Verlander. Now you're giving these guys more rest between starts, trusting better arms, and Greinke's only going to get better with that Houston coaching staff. Just see what Verlander did in 2017 after being traded. The prospectus, the Astros win the American League pennant.
Oof. You know, there's a big difference between saying, are they the favorite? Baseball has a tendency, sure isn't like the NBA. The best teams in the NBA, they get in the playoffs and they're healthy. They just win it. The Astros, well, I'll play the odds here. Man, they look like they are now, if not head and shoulders above everybody, a head above everybody.
Head and neck.
I will buy the Astros as the American League champions.
While there were plenty of teams making moves that stayed quiet were the most, the teams that didn't make any and stayed quiet were the most interesting. The Mets were thought to be wanting to move Noah Syndergaard, even moving up his start so that he wouldn't be traded today, messing up their rotation, but who cares? They're 11 back, and it's the Mets. The Giants were also, up until a month ago, were going to be moving Madison Bumgarner. He stayed in San Francisco. The Gigantes did move Drew Pomeranz, who in all of 2 weeks went from a failed starter to like third or second best K per nine in the Giants bullpen. Will Smith, a perfect reliever who was worth his weight in prospects, also stayed. The Giants are 2.5 back of the wild card, and that seemed that this hot month was more than just a fun streak, but signs of things to come. Well, they got one good infield prospect in Mauricio Dubon. They could have gotten much more had they moved Smith, but hey, I'm here for the push to October, so let's go Giants. As for the Mets and their not moves, who knows what's going on? They wanted to use Stroman as more or less of a Thor replacement and use the prospects they got back from the Wheeler Syndergaard trades to reload on the fly rather than a rebuild, but here they are with all of these pitchers and down prospects at the end of everything, but man, I guess next year might be fun. The prospectus, the Giants and Mets were right to both not sell their best players at the deadline.
Buy that. I was against that from the get-go. Syndergaard and Bumgarner don't come along all that often. And what they could have gotten in return, unless somebody was just like, I must have that guy, and you're going to give up three top prospects and like a starter.
I would love to hear what some of these deals that like teams were rejecting at this point, because Greinke basically went for four prospects and then just like a little bit of money. So the Astros are still paying off like a good portion of that contract. And it just, I cannot wait to hear all the details of things that pop out over the next couple of months or into the offseason about, you know, players that were offered and who said no and what the prospects became and who did what in October. Ooh, today just got very fun for baseball.
Amazing. And it was just like, just wait. No, just wait. No. Just wait. It's like when the scene in Trading Places when Eddie Murphy was telling the Duke brothers, wait a little bit more. The you need to save money. That father wants to buy his son the G.I. Joe with the Kung Fu grip. And they're starting to panic now. I could feel it. And then all of a sudden at 12:58, let her rip. Trade him. I need him. I want that guy. Get rid of this guy. We want prospects for him. And our bullpen's better. Go! All right, looking ahead to the 4 o'clock hour, we'll actually, rather than just ranting and raving, we'll actually talk about some of the specifics of the MLB deals. I've got some Pac-12 notes, some NFL, and an interesting comment about teams who win the World Series and what they do at the trade deadline. Coming up next, 95.3 The Score.
What did we just see? Holy smokes!